They are sad, you see. The story goes, and this is not a reflection on anyone here today, the story goes that there was a couple who had been married for well over 50 years. They lived in a run-down farmhouse and were able, between them, to eke out a living doing marginal amounts of farming. Perhaps it was the stress of their marginal existence, or maybe they had just grown tired of each other, but their relationship had deteriorated over the years. They had taken to being cold and very hostile to each other. But what choice did they have but to stick it out? One day at breakfast, the wife suddenly keeled over into her porridge and died. The husband immediately called the local undertaker to come to the farmhouse and collect the body. As the two men from the funeral home were making their way out of the house, one of the men tripped over a rose bush in the front garden, thereby dropping the coffin containing the body. The coffin went down with a tremendous crash, the lid popped open, and the wife sat right up, right as rain. It would seem that the jolt had somehow brought her back to the land of the living. Well, life returned to its unsteady rhythm that the couple had developed over the years, and for three long years, their heated relationship ventured on. Then one morning, the wife keeled over again and once again died. Once again, the undertaker was called to collect the body. And as the two men were carrying the coffin out for the second time in 3 years, the old man was heard to say one parting sentence: "For goodness sakes, watch out for that rose bush." "Until death do us part." Those familiar words used to be a regular part of every Christian wedding service. It was a vow people took seriously, even living in difficult relationships, because they had made a promise. In fact, I remember a very funny scene from an old night court sitcom episode in which a very elderly couple were brought in before the judge. They were arrested because they'd been disturbing the peace with their constant loud bickering and the throwing of objects at each other in their apartment. And the judge asked them, "How long have they been married?" And they replied venomously, "60 years. "Well, if you hate each other so much," the judge said, "why in the world do you stay together?" And they replied, "Well, we're waiting for the children to die." I do hope for your own mental health, your marriage is a better experience than just sitting around waiting for the other person to die. On the other side of the marriage coin is the oft-repeated sentiment that couples express to each other, that they will love each other forever. Hidden within this sentiment is the idea that somehow in heaven we will be coupled for eternity. In fact, Mormon believers have taken this erroneous view even further by holding special secret marriage ceremonies here on earth that are supposed to join two people in marriage in heaven for eternity. Marriage seems then to be the focus of a lot of speculation in regards to what happens to this relationship at death. Even though our marriage vows clearly state that the link is severed at death, we still want to know what happens next. The Christian view taken from this passage in Luke and in others is that marriage is an earthly institution that has no place in heaven. In heaven, you will neither be married nor will you be seeking to be married to your current spouse or to a new person. Now, some of you might be breathing a sigh of relief over that. Maybe some of you are saddened by that news. This confusion over what happens in relationships we enjoy on earth after we die has been around for a very long time. In particular, today's passage introduces us to a group of Jewish theologians who used this confusion to press their main objective. The Sadducees, like the Pharisees and the Essenes and the scribes, were a group of religious scholars, and this time these scholars came from elite families within the priestly caste. They are of Aaron's descent. Sadducees, like the Pharisees, were members of the Sanhedrin. They had considerable influence in religious matters that were before the Sanhedrin or the Jewish court. They too had grown to despise Jesus because he was gaining an influence among the people, an influence that they were accustomed to enjoying for themselves. So just like the Pharisees and the scribes, the Sadducees sought ways to trap Jesus into saying something in order to embarrass or anger the crowds or the Romans. In today's passage, the Sadducees, who had just listened to Jesus deal with the issue of paying taxes, step forward with their own agenda. In the world of Jewish religion in the first century AD, the Sadducees differed from their contemporaries on at least two major points of theology. Unlike the Pharisees, who took great liberties in creating further rules and regulations, which Jesus referred to as a burden on the people, Sadducees believed that if it wasn't in the Pentateuch, that is the first five books of the Bible, then it wasn't to be followed at all. It's hard to imagine this, but in terms of Jewish theology, the Pharisees were seen by the Sadducees as being liberals and saw themselves as conservatives. The Sadducees, also like the Pharisees, did not believe in the overriding providence of God. In other words, they did not believe God brought about events in people's lives. They believed that whatever happened to you, good or bad, was because of something you did. The point of their theology that is before us today is that of the resurrection of the dead. The Pharisees believed in the resurrection and they believed in angels. But the Sadducees rejected both ideas. They believed that when the body died, the soul was dead as well. Their belief stems from the fact that there are few references to life after death in the Old Testament, particularly in those first five books. Theirs was not a very hope-filled position, is it? So to try and discredit Jesus and further their personal agenda in their dispute with the Pharisees, they come to Jesus and they ask him a theoretical question. In the law of Moses, which the Sadducees revere, there is a provision for what is called levirate marriage. Mentioned in Genesis 38 verse 8 and Deuteronomy 25 verse 5, as well as it's also referred to in the book of Ruth chapter 4, the law commands that when a man dies, leaving his wife childless, his brother is to take the widow as his wife and raise up children for his deceased brother. The point being that the resulting children would not be the father's, but rather would be the sons or daughters of the brother who was deceased. This is the law of Moses, the Sadducees would argue, and if this is the word of God, what would happen, they said, if a man died and left his wife childless and his brother took her for his wife? Then a second brother dies, again leaving no children, and the third brother takes the woman as his wife. Then let's say this scenario goes on for seven brothers, and finally the woman dies herself without children. I heard one preacher remark that she probably died to get away from that ridiculous family, I'll tell you. So then the Pharisees ask the question, whose wife then shall she be in the resurrection, since she's been married to all seven brothers? First of all, I need to state that this theoretical question is based on an implausible situation. There's no recorded incident of a woman being subjected to seven brothers like this. And by the time Jesus is born, levirate marriage has actually faded from common usage among Jews. I need to point out to you that the Sadducees must have felt pretty smug at this moment. From their theological position, they thought this little scenario proved their point that there was no resurrection. In fact, this was probably a scenario that they used in their debates with the Pharisees on the subject of the resurrection. To prove this, I direct you to a little-known, incredible moment in the Apostle Paul's life. It's in Acts 23, verses 6 to 8. In this passage, Paul is on trial before the Sanhedrin for preaching about Jesus. In the midst of the trial, Luke records these words. Paul realized that some members of the high council were Sadducees and some were Pharisees, so he shouted, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, so were all my ancestors, and I'm on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." Luke states simply in that passage, this divided the council, the Pharisees against the Sadducees. A subsequent clamor arose in the court, and Paul had to literally be removed by force, lest he be torn apart by the two fighting factions. So I need to ask you, or we need to ask, who's this question really directed at? Is it really directed at Jesus, or is it directed at the Pharisees? The issue the Pharisees are raising really isn't about marriage. It's about authority. Where does one derive one's theological views? So Jesus does two things in response. The first thing he does is he corrects their misconceptions about the resurrection, especially when it pertains to marriage. Bottom line, he says, there's no marriage in heaven. But the real issue Jesus addresses is the false idea that there's no proof of the resurrection in the Pentateuch or those first five books of Moses. So Jesus refers the Sadducees to a passage they would have known by heart. It's in Exodus 3:6. Moses is standing before the burning bush on the mountain, the one that wasn't consumed by flames. Powerful moment. It's a sacred moment for all Jewish believers. It is at the very heart of their identity as God's people. Everyone standing there listening to Jesus that day would know that story intimately. Moses recorded his experience of standing before the burning bush by referring to God as the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. These words are familiar. They are a revered expression of God's identification with the patriarchs of the faith. And then Jesus makes this point, that God refers to himself this way, and no Sadducee would argue against the validity of those words coming directly from God himself. What is significant then is God is referring to himself as the God of these men who had long since died. It means clearly that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are still in a relationship with God. This is true, Jesus says, because God is a God of the living, not a God of the dead. Jesus adds, they are all alive to him. What Jesus is saying in this strategy of his is that the Sadducees, they can't have it both ways. They cannot, on the one hand, quote Moses on the subject of levirate marriage, and on the other hand, ignore the words of Moses that proves there is a resurrection. The Pharisees, remember them? They're still there. They were listening to this. And their response to the question that they've probably heard hundreds of times from the Sadducees was, "Well said, teacher." You can almost see them, the Pharisees, gloating at this response. I wonder now how Jesus' own proof of the resurrection was subsequently quoted in heated debates in the high council. Unfortunately, as we read in the book of Acts, the Sadducees had not changed their position on the resurrection. In fact, in Acts chapter 4, they get quite hostile towards the early church, primarily because it was teaching that Jesus had been raised from the dead. This whole 20th chapter of Luke begins with religious leaders, Sadducees, priests, Pharisees, scribes, all coming and challenging Jesus' authority. All through this chapter, Jesus is raising the same issue. The religious leaders, the people are following are inconsistent. They desire to be authoritative, but they are marred by hypocrisy. They read the Word of God and they interpret it to fit their own preconceived ideas or to promote their personal agenda. The Pharisees, for their part, create new laws that burden the people in order to make themselves look good in comparison to others. And Jesus is stating to the crowd that one of the most important choices that we will make in life is whose authority are we going to submit to? Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." If we want to approach God in this life or the next, then our authority has to be with whom? Jesus. In thinking about the critical issues of our lives, who or what we listen to, informing our ideas, our theology, our life's philosophy, are we consistent in following our authority? The example in question has to do with marriage and what happens to that relationship after we die. Jesus is clear that in heaven we are neither married nor given in marriage. Marriage is an earthly institution that's designed to help the human race thrive. Well, maybe for most of us. You know, sometimes our desire for authority can go a bit awry, can't it? Such as an office manager who was complaining in the staff meeting that he wasn't getting the respect he deserved from his employees. So the next day he put a small sign on his office door, "I am the boss." Later on that day, he returned from lunch to find that someone had taped a note over his sign. It read, "Your wife called. She wants the sign back." If our authority is Jesus, then what does it say to us about all the sentimental fluff being espoused by contemporary music, movies, and literature that relates to marriage or relationships? Are we compromised by condoning ideas that marriage is eternal, or that it's unnecessary, or that it's disposable? Jesus' point is that whatever our final authority in life is, we have to be consistent. We cannot take the parts we like and forward our own agenda and ignore those that challenge us or critique our lifestyle or life choices. We cannot claim the hope of the resurrection without accepting our need to be faithful to the one who purchased that hope by going to the cross. Are we consistent in our message to the world and how we view important relationships in our lives like marriages? It is time to see things the way Jesus sees them. For in the end, it's only his opinion that matters.